This is Audible.
Remote Control by Andy McNab. Read by Paul Thornley. Gibraltar, Sunday the 6th of March, 1988. We didn't know which of the three was going to detonate the bomb. All Simmons had been able to tell us was that it was a big one, and that it would be initiated remotely. For now, though, there was nothing to do but wait. The security service had triggers out on the checkpoints with mainland Spain. Until the players were sighted, Pat, Kev and I were to stay exactly where we were, sitting outside a cafe just off Main Street, drinking coffee, looking and listening. The spring air was crisp and clear under a blindingly blue Mediterranean sky. The morning sun just starting to make it comfortable enough for shirt sleeves. The trees that lined the square were packed with birds so small I couldn't see them amongst the foliage, but they made enough noise to drown out the sound of traffic going up and down the main drag, just out of sight. Through my earpiece, I heard Ewan make a radio check to the operations room. Everything he said on the net was very precise, very clear, very calm. Ewan was the tidiest man in the world. If you sat on a cushion, he would puff it up again the moment you stood up. Dedication was his middle name. I heard a loud hiss of air brakes and looked up. A tour bus had turned into the square and was parking up about 20 meters away. The sign in the windscreen said, "Young at Heart." I didn't pay much attention. I was bored, looking for things to do. The lace on one of my trainers had come undone. I bent to do it up and got a jab in the ribs from the hammer of the 9mm Browning. The holster was covert, inside my jeans. That way, only the pistol grip would be in view if I pulled open my black nylon bomber jacket. I preferred to have my pistol at the front. A lot of the blokes wore theirs on the side, but I never could get used to it. Once you find a position you like, you don't change. You might be in the shit one day. Go to draw your weapon, and it isn't there. It's several more inches to the right, and you're dead. I had an extended 20-round magazine protruding from the pistol grip. I also had three standard 13-round mags on my belt, reckoning that if 59 rounds weren't enough, I shouldn't be doing this for a living. The senior citizens began disembarking from the bus. They were typical Brits abroad. The men dressed almost identically, beige flannels, sensible shoes and a V-neck sweater over a shirt and tie. Most of the women were in crimpoline slacks with elasticated waistbands and a sewn-in crease down the front. They all had flawless, blow-dried, jet-black, white or blue-rinsed hair. They spotted the cafe and started to move as a herd towards us. Pat muttered, "Fuck me. Pyro must be getting desperate. They've sent the Barry Manilow fan club. Friends of yours, Grandad?" He grinned at Kev, who offered him a finger to swivel on. Whether you like it or not, you have to quit the SAS at the age of 40. And Kev had just a year or two of his contract to run. The young at heart settled down at nearby tables and picked up the menus. It was now big-time decisions for them. Whether to have cakes or go for a sandwich. Because it was halfway between Elevens's and lunchtime, and they didn't know which way to jump. The waiter came out, and they started talking to him one syllable at a time. He looked at them as if they were mad. On the net I heard, "Hello, all call signs, this is Alpha. Radio check, over." Alpha, who was located in the ops room, was our controller. When we'd flown in 36 hours earlier, our team of 8 SAS soldiers and support staff had requisitioned rooms in the accommodation block at HMS Rook, the British naval base in the docks, and turned them into living space. Kev responded quietly into his concealed microphone. "Golf. Pat. Oscar. I heard Ewan. November. My turn came. Delta." The elderly Brits started taking pictures of themselves. Then they were swapping cameras so they could appear in their own photographs. Slack Pat got up and said to one of them, "Here you are, love. Want me to take one of all of you?" "Oh, you're from England, are you? Isn't it nice and warm now?" slack, was early 30s, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, good-looking, clever, articulate, funny. He was everything I hated. He was also 6'2", and one of those people who naturally shit muscle. Even his hair was well-toned. I'd seen him climb into his sleeping bag with it looking groomed and perfect, and wake up with it in the same condition. Pat's only saving grace, as far as I was concerned, was that when he stood up, there was nothing where his arse should have been. We used to call him Slack, because he had lots of it. He had just started doing a David Bailey when we got, "Stand by, stand by," on the net from one of the female triggers. "That's a possible, a possible. Bravo one towards the town square." Alpha came back. "Roger that, Delta. Acknowledge." I got to my feet, gave two clicks on the radio pressle that was wired into my jacket pocket, and started walking. It was pointless, all three of us moving at this stage. Families on their Sunday paseo strolled across from my left. Tourists were taking pictures of buildings, looking at maps and scratching their heads. Locals were sitting down enjoying the weather, walking their dogs, playing with their grandchildren. There were two men with comfortable-looking beer bellies, old and not giving a fuck, smoking themselves to death. Trousers with big braces, shirt and vest, soaking up the March sun. I wondered how many of them would survive if the bomb went off just here. I was just starting to get in my stride when a very excited male trigger shouted, "Stand by, stand by! That's also a possible Bravo 2 and Echo 1 at the top end of Main Street." This got me quite sparked up. I listened for Ewan. His task in this operation was the same as mine, to confirm the possibles with a positive ID. I imagined him sauntering along the pavement like me. He was short, with an acne-scarred face and the world's biggest motorbike, which he could just about keep upright because his toes only brushed the ground. I liked to take the piss out of him about it as often as I could. I knew the guy like a brother. In fact, probably better. Hadn't seen any of my family for over 20 years. Ewan and I had been young soldiers together. We'd passed selection at the same time, and we'd been working together ever since. The fucker was so unflappable, I always thought his heart must have only just about ticked over. I'd been with him in Hereford when the police arrived to tell him that his sister had been murdered. He just said, "I think I'd better go to London then, and sort things out." It wasn't that he didn't care. He just didn't get excited about anything. That sort of calm is contagious. It always made me feel secure to have guys like him around me. I hit Main Street and pinged Bravo 1 straight away. I got on the net. "Alpha, this is Delta. That's confirmed. Bravo 1, brown, pinstripe on faded blue." He always wore that brown, pinstriped suit jacket. He'd had it for so long that it sagged in the pockets, and there were constant creases in the back from where he'd been wearing it in a car. And the same old, faded and threadbare jeans, the crotch halfway down between his bollocks and his knees. He was walking away from me. Stocky, slight, stoop, short hair, long sideboards. But I recognised the gait. I knew it was Sean Savage. I followed him to a small square at the bottom end of Main Street, near the governor's residence, where the band of the resident British Infantry Battalion would fall out after the changing of the guard. It was where Simmons suspected the Pyra team might plant their bomb. Alpha, the base station controlling the operation for now, repeated the message so that everyone knew which direction Savage was walking in. I knew that Gulf and Oscar, Kev and Slack Pat, would soon start moving up behind me. There were 6 or 7 cars parked up against the wall of an old colonial building, taking advantage of the shade. I saw Bravo 1 push his hand into his jacket pocket as he headed towards them. For a split second, I thought he was going for the initiation device. Without checking his stride, Savage focused on one vehicle in particular and headed towards it. I moved slightly to the right, so I had a clear view of the number plate. "Alpha, this is Delta," I said. That's Bravo 1 now at vehicle Mike Lima 174412. I pictured Alpha with a bank of computers in front of him in the control room. He confirmed. Roger that. Mike Alpha 174412. That's a white Renault 5. It's on the right. Third car from the entrance, I said. That's nose in. By now the keys were in Savage's hands. Stop, stop, stop. Bravo 1 at the car. He's at the car. I was committed to passing him quite close now. I couldn't just change direction. I could see his profile. His chin and top lip were full of zits, and I knew what that meant. Under pressure, his acne always blew up. Savage was still at the Renault. He turned, now with his back to me, pretending to sort his keys out. But I knew he'd be checking the telltales. A sliver of sellotape across a door. Things arranged in a certain way inside the vehicle, whatever. If they were not as he had left them, Savage would lift off. Kev and Slack Pat would be somewhere near the entrance to the square, ready to back. If I got overexposed to the target, one of them would take over, or if I got in the shit and had a contact, they would have to finish it. And we'd all worked together long enough for me to know that. As mates, as well as colleagues, they'd let nothing stand between them and the task. The buildings were casting shadows across the square. I couldn't feel any breeze, just the change in temperature as I moved out of the sunlight. I was too close to Savage now to transmit. As I walked past the car, I could hear the keys going in and the click of the lock. I headed for a wooden bench on the far side of the square and sat down. There were newspapers in a bin next to me. I picked one out and sat watching him. Savage made a suspicious movement, and I got back on the net. Alpha, this is Delta. That's his feet outside. He's fiddling underneath the dashboard. He's fiddling under the dashboard. Wait. I had my finger on the pressel, so I was still commanding the net. Could he be making the final connection to the bomb? As I was doing my ventriloquist act, an old boy wandered towards me, pushing his bike. The fucker was on his way over for a chat. I took my finger off the pressel and waited. I was deeply involved in the local newspaper, but I didn't have a clue what it said. He obviously thought I did. I didn't want to stick around and discuss the weather. But I wasn't gonna just fuck him off either, because he might start jumping up and down and draw Savage's attention. The old boy stopped, one hand on his bike, the other flailing around. He asked me a question. I didn't understand a word he was saying. I pulled a face that said I didn't know what the world was coming to, shrugged, and looked down again at the paper. I'd obviously done the wrong thing. He said some angry shit, and then wheeled his bike away, arm still flailing. I got back on the radio. I couldn't exactly see what Savage was doing, but both of his feet were still outside the Renault. He had his arse on the driver's seat and was leaning underneath the dash. It looked as if he was trying to get something out of the glove compartment, as if he'd forgotten something and gone back to get it. I couldn't confirm what he was doing, but his hands kept going into his pockets. Everything was closing in. I felt like a boxer. I could hear the crowd. I was listening to my seconds and the referee. I was listening for the bell. But mostly I was focused on the boy I was fighting. Nothing else mattered. Nothing. The only important people in the world were me and Bravo One. Through my earpiece, I could hear Ewan working like a man possessed, trying to get on top of the other two terrorists. Kev and Slack Pat were still backing me. The other two boys in our team were with Ewan. They'd all still be satelliting, listening on the net so as to be out of sight of the targets, but always close enough to back us if we got in the shit. Ewan closed in on Bravo 2 and Echo 1. They were coming in our direction. Everybody knew where they were. Everybody would keep out of the way so they had a clear run in. I recognized them as soon as they turned the corner. Bravo 2 was Daniel Martin McCann. Unlike Savage, who was well-educated and an expert bomb maker, Mad Danny was a butcher by trade and a butcher by nature. He'd been expelled from the movement by Gerry Adams in 1985 for threatening to initiate a campaign of murder that would have hampered the new political strategy. It was a bit like being kicked out of the Gestapo for cruelty. But McCann had supporters, and soon got himself reinstated. Married with two children, he had 26 killings linked to his name. Ulster loyalists had tried to slot him once, but failed. They should have tried harder. Echo One was Mairead Farrell. Middle class and an ex-convent schoolgirl. She was, at 31, one of the highest-ranking women in the IRA. See her picture and you'd think, oh, an angel. But she'd served 10 years for planting a bomb in Belfast and reported back for duty as soon as she'd been released. Things hadn't gone her way. A few months earlier, her lover had accidentally blown himself up. As Simmons had said at the briefing, that made her one very pissed off Echo One. I knew them both well. Ewan and I had been working against them for years. I got on the net and confirmed the ID. Everybody was in place. Alpha would be in the control room with the senior policeman. People from the Foreign Office, people from the Home Office, you name it. Every man and his dog would be there. Everybody wanting to put their tuppence worth in. Everybody with their own concerns. We could only hope that Simmons would be looking after ours. I'd only met the Secret Intelligence Service desk officer for Northern Ireland a couple of days earlier, but he certainly seemed to be running our side of the show. His voice had the sort of confidence that was shaped on the playing fields of Eton, and he measured his words slowly, like a big-time attorney with a meter running. We wanted the decision made now, but I knew there would be big debates going on in the ops room. You'd probably have to cut your way through the cigarette smoke with a knife. Our liaison officer would be listening to us on his radio and explaining everything that we were doing, confirming that the team was in position. At crunch time, it was the police, not us, who'd decide that we went in. Once it was handed over to the military, Kev would control the team. The frustration was outrageous. I just wanted to get this over. By now, Farrell was leaning against the driver's door, the two men standing and facing her. If I hadn't known differently, I'd have said they were trying to chat her up. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but their faces showed no sign of stress, and now and then I could hear laughter above the traffic noise. Savage even got out a packet of mints and passed them round. I was still giving a running commentary when Alpha came back on the net. Hello, all call signs, I have control, Gulf acknowledge. Kev acknowledged. The police had handed over. It was Kev's show now. The targets started to move away from the vehicle, and I clicked the pressel 4 times. Gulf came back. Stand by, stand by. That was it. We were off. I let them walk towards the main square, and then I got up. I knew we wouldn't lift them here. There were far too many people around. For all we knew, the players might want to go out in a blaze of glory and start dropping the civilians, take them hostage, or even worse, go into kamikaze mode and detonate the device. Alpha came back on the net. Hello, all call signs, cancel, cancel, cancel. I do not have control, cancel, Gulf acknowledge. At once, I heard Kev's not-so-formal reply.
What the fuck's going on? Tell me, what's going on?
Wait, wait. Alpha sounded under pressure. There were voices in the background. All stations, the police need another ID. They need to be sure. Gulf acknowledge. What do they want? Introductions? Hi, I'm Danny, bomber and murderer. I enjoy travelling and working with children. We were in danger of losing them if we didn't act soon. Alpha came back. All stations, ATO is moving to check the vehicle. Delta, we need that confirmation. I acknowledged. There was obviously some flapping going on in the ops room. The boss was getting a hard time from the police, and it sounded like a chimp's tea party in there. The terrorist team would be crossing the border within minutes. Once they were on the other side, they could detonate the bomb with immunity. I was now on the other side of the road, and wanted at least to get parallel to them so that I could see their faces again. I had to reconfirm the players, then stick with them. More activity on the net. I could hear the tension in Alpha's voice now. Telephone lines ringing, people milling about. Kev cut in. Fuck the ops room. Let's keep on top of them until someone somewhere makes a fucking decision. Lima and Zulu, can you get forward? Zulu came on the net for himself and Lima, very much out of breath. Zulu and Lima, we can do that. Roger that, move up. Tell me when you're there. Kev wanted them beyond the health center. They were running hard to get ahead of the targets. They didn't care who saw them, as long as the players didn't. But we still hadn't got control. Kev came back on the net. Alpha, this is Golf. You need to get your finger out now. We're going to lose them. What do you want us to do? Golf, wait. Wait. I could still hear noise in the background. Lots of talking, more telephones ringing, people shouting instructions. Everything went quiet. Wait. Wait. All I could hear now was the background noise of Alpha on my radio, plus my pulse pounding in my head. Then at last, the voice of Simmons very clear, a voice you wouldn't argue with. I heard him say to Alpha, "Tell the ground commander he can continue." "All call signs, this is Alpha, I have control, I have control, Golf acknowledge." Kev got on the net, and instead of acknowledging said, "Thank fuck for that. All call signs. If they get as far as the airport, we'll lift them there. If not, on my word. On my word. Zulu and Lima, how's it going?" They came back on the net. "That's our static at the junction. We can take..." They were at the intersection of Main Street and Smith Dorian Avenue, the main approach road to the crossing into Spain. The players were moving towards them. I could lift off soon. I'd done the job I'd been brought here to do. I prepared myself for the handover. But then they stopped. Fuck. "Stop, stop, stop," I said. "That's Bravo 1, 2 and Echo 1 static." Everybody was closing in. "Come on, let's lift them here and now." Savage split from the other two and headed back the way they'd come, towards the town centre. It was all going to ratchet. We had two groups to control now, and we didn't know who had the initiation device. Kev arrived to back me. On the net, I could hear the other two players being followed towards the border by the rest of the team as I moved in to take Savage. He turned left down an alleyway. I was just about to get on the net when I heard a police siren, followed by gunfire behind me. At the same instant, Ewan came on the net. "Contact! Contact!" Then more shots. Kev and I looked at each other. What the fuck was going on? We ran round the corner. Savage had heard the shots too and turned back towards us. Even at this distance I could see his eyes, big as plates, and jerking like he was having a seizure. There was a woman pedestrian between us. Kev shouted, "Stop! Security forces, stop!" With his left hand, he had to push the woman over to the side and bang her against the wall to keep her out of the way. She was going down, blood pouring from her head. At least she wouldn't get up and become a target. She began screaming. We had Kev hollering and screaming at Savage, and all the people in the area were starting to scream. It was turning into a gangfuck. Kev flicked back the right side of his sports jacket to reach the pancake holster over his kidneys. We always put a bit of weight in a pocket. A full mag is good, to help the jacket flick back out of the way. But I wasn't really looking at Kev. I was looking at Savage. I could see his hand moving to the right side of his jacket. He wasn't some knuckle-dragging moron from the back streets. The moment he saw us, he knew the score. It was decision time. Kev drew his pistol, brought it up, and went to fire. Nothing. "Stoppage! Fuck! Nick! Fuck! Fuck!" Trying to clear his weapon, he dropped on one knee to make himself a smaller target. Now is when everything seems to go into slow motion. Savage and I had eye to eye. He knew what I was going to do. He could have stopped. He could have put his hands up. My bomber jacket was held together with Velcro, so at times like this I could just pull it apart and draw my pistol. The only way a weapon can be drawn and used quickly is by breaking the whole movement into stages. Stage one, I kept looking at the target. With my left hand, I grabbed a fistful of bomber jacket and pulled it as hard as I could towards my chest. The Velcro ripped apart. At the same time, I was sucking in my stomach and sticking out my chest to make the pistol grip easy to access. You only get one chance. We still had eye contact. He started to shout, but I didn't hear. There was too much other shouting going on, from everyone on the street and the earpiece in my head. Stage two. I pushed the web of my right hand down onto the pistol grip. If I got this wrong, I wouldn't be able to aim correctly. I would miss and die. As I felt my web push against the pistol grip, my lower three fingers gripped hard around it. My index finger was outside the trigger guard, parallel with the barrel. I didn't want to pull the trigger early and kill myself. Savage was still looking, still shouting. Savage's hand was nearly at his pocket. Stage three. I drew my weapon, in the same movement, taking the safety catch off with my thumb. Our eyes were still locked. I saw that Savage knew he had lost. There was just a curling of the lips. He knew he was going to die. As my pistol came out, I flicked it parallel with the ground. No time to extend my arms and get into a stable firing position. Stage four. My left hand was still pulling my jacket out of the way, and the pistol was now just by my belt buckle. There was no need to look at it. I knew where it was and what it was pointing at. I kept my eyes on the target and his never left mine. I pulled the trigger. The weapon report seemed to bring everything back into real time. The first round hit him. I didn't know where, I didn't need to. His eyes told me all I wanted to know. I kept on firing. There is no such thing as overkill. If he could move, he could detonate the bomb. If it took a whole magazine to be sure I'd stopped the threat, then that was what I'd fire. As Savage hit the ground, I could no longer see his hands. He was curled up in a ball, holding his stomach. I moved forward and fired two aimed shots at the head. He was no longer a threat. Kev ran over and was searching inside Savage's coat. "It's not here," he said. "No weapon, no firing device." I looked down at Kev as he wiped the blood off his hands onto Savage's jeans. "One of the others must have had it," he said. "I didn't hear the car go up, did you?" In all the confusion, I couldn't be sure. I stood over them both. Kev's mother came from southern Spain, and he looked like a local. Jet black hair, about 5 feet 10 inches, and the world's bluest eyes. His wife reckoned he was a dead ringer for Mel Gibson, which he scoffed at but secretly liked. Right now his face was a picture. He knew he owed me one. I wanted to say, "It's okay, these things happen." But it just didn't seem like the time. Instead I said, "Fucking hell, Brown. What do you expect if you have a name the same colour as shit?" As I spoke, we put our safety catches on and Kev and I swapped weapons. "I'm glad I won't be at any inquest," I grinned at Kev. "You'd better start getting your shit together." He smiled as he got on the radio and started to send a sit rep. It was all right for him and the others, but Ewan and I shouldn't have been here. We had to vanish before the police arrived. The ops room was about 15 minutes away on foot. I tucked Kev's weapon inside my jeans and started walking fast. The mood was subdued aboard the C-130 as it lifted from the tarmac at 11 p.m. that night. Spanish police found Pyra's car bomb in an underground car park in Marbella, 30 miles away. 145 pounds of Semtex high explosive and an unattached timing device preset at 11:20 a.m. The time the Gibraltar guard-changing ceremony ended and the soldiers dispersed in the square. The white Renault had been a blocking vehicle after all. When Simmons came over, Pat said, "As far as we knew, they had the means to detonate a bomb big enough to separate Gibraltar from the mainland. All it would have taken was one press of a button. If there's going to be an inquest, fuck it. Better to be tried by 12, I say, than carried by 6. For Ewan and me, there would be no guest appearances at any inquest. We were undercover in Northern Ireland with 14 Intelligence Group. It was illegal for its members to operate anywhere else. If either of us had been caught in Gibraltar, there would have been a shitstorm." Deafened, suddenly, by the roar of the C-130's engines, I glanced at Kev, Pat, Ewan, and tried to forget what I was going back to. A house isn't a home when there are no pictures on the walls. In the Gulf, Pat had a battle cry. "All for one, and one for all." We'd laughed when he used it, but he was spot on. Any one of us would put his life on the line for the others. I cracked a smile. With these guys around me, who needed family? Without a doubt, I thought, this was as good as it was ever going to get. 1997. Chapter 1. If you work for the British Intelligence Service and get formally summoned to a meeting at their headquarters building on the south bank of the Thames at Vauxhall, there are 3 levels of interview. First is the one with coffee and biscuits, which means they're going to give you a pat on the head. Next, down the food chain, is the more business-like coffee but no biscuits, which means they're not asking but telling you to follow orders. And finally, there's no biscuits and no coffee either, which basically means that you're in the shit. Since leaving the regiment in 1993 and working as a K on deniable operations, I'd had a number of interviews at every level. And I wasn't expecting a nice frothy cappuccino to be on the cards this particular Monday. In fact, I was flapping quite severely, because things hadn't been going too well. As I emerged from the tube station at Vauxhall, the omens weren't exactly with me either. The March sky was dull and overcast, preparing itself for the Easter holiday. My path was blocked by roadworks, and a burst from a jackhammer sounded like the crack of a firing squad. Vauxhall Cross, home of what the press call MI6, but which is actually the Secret Intelligence Service, is about a mile upstream of the Houses of Parliament. Bizarrely shaped like a beige and black pyramid that's had its top cut off, with staged levels, large towers either side and a terrace bar overlooking the river. It only needs a few swirls of neon, and you'd swear it was a casino. It wouldn't look out of place in Las Vegas. I missed Century House, the old HQ building near Waterloo Station. It might have been 1960s ugly, square, with loads of glass, net curtains and antenna. And not so handy for the tube, but it was much more homely. Opposite Vauxhall Cross, and about 200 metres across the wide arterial road, is an elevated section of railway line, and beneath that are arches that have been turned into shops, 2 of which have been knocked through to make a massive motorbike shop. I was early, so I popped in and fantasised about which Ducati I was going to buy when I got a pay rise, which wasn't going to be today. What the hell? The way my luck was going, I'd probably go and kill myself on it. I'd fucked up severely. I'd been sent to Saudi to encourage, then train, some northern Iraqi Kurds to kill 3 leading members of the Ba'ath Party. The hope was that the assassinations would spark everything up and help dismantle the regime in Baghdad. The first part of my task was to take delivery in Saudi of some former Eastern Bloc weapons that had been smuggled in. Russian Dragunov sniper weapons, a couple of Makarov pistols and 2 AK assault rifles, the parachute version with a folding stock. All serial numbers had been erased to make them deniable. For maximum chaos, the plan was to get the Kurds to make 3 hits at exactly the same time in and around Baghdad. One was going to be a close-quarters shoot using the Makarovs. The idea was for the 2 boys to walk up to the family house, knock on the door, take on whatever threat presented itself, make entry into the house, zap the target and run. The second was going to be a sniper option. The target saw himself as a big-time fitness freak. He'd come out and have a little jog round a running track, all of about 400 metres. He emerged from his house every day in a lime green, fluffy, velour shell suit. Did one lap, and that was his training for the day. The boys were going to hit him just as he started to sweat and slow down, which, by the look of him, would be after about 100 metres. I would be on this one to coordinate the hit so that both fired at once. The third target was going to be taken out on his way to the ministry. Two bikes would pull up at traffic lights and give him the good news with their AK-47s. I landed up in northern Iraq without any problems and started the build-up training. At this stage, not even the Kurds knew what their task was going to be. The Dragunov sniper rifles were a heap of shit. However, the weapon is never as important as the ammunition, which in this case was even worse. Indian 7.62mm. Given a free hand, I would have wanted to use Lapua, manufactured in Finland and the best in the world for sniping because of its consistency. But Western rounds would have given the game away. The Indian ammunition was hit and miss. Mostly miss. On top of that, the Dragunovs were semi-automatic rifles. Ideally, you need a bolt-action weapon, which is not only better for taking the hit, it also doesn't leave an empty case behind because it stays in the weapon until you reload. However, it had to be Russian kit that they were zapped with, and it had to be deniable. Once all three jobs went down, the weapons were dumped in a hide and should have been destroyed. They weren't. On the AK there is a forward leaf sight, and underneath that is scratched a serial number. I had been told that all serial numbers had been removed at source and had taken the information at face value. I didn't check. I fucked up. The only way to retrieve the situation as far as London was concerned was to kill the Kurd teams I'd been training. It was damage limitation on a drastic scale, but it had to be done. Detail counts. If the Iraqis could trace the weapons back, they might make the UK connection. If they then captured the Kurds, who just happened to mention the fact that they had been trained by a Westerner called Nick Stone, it wouldn't take a mastermind to work out which country he came from. It actually pissed me off to have to kill them, because I'd got to know these boys really well. To this day, I was still wearing the G-Shock watch one of the snipers had given me. We'd had a bet when we were on the range, and he lost. I knew that I could beat him, but still cheated because I had to win. I'd really got to like him. Back in the UK, there had been an inquiry, and everybody was covering their arse. And because I was a K, they could land it all on me. The armourers and technicians from the intelligence service said it was my fault for not checking. What could I say? I didn't even exist. I was bracing myself to take the hit. I entered Vauxhall Cross via a single metal door that funneled me towards reception. Inside, the building could be mistaken for any high-tech office block in any city. Very clean, slick, and corporate. People who worked there were swiping their identity cards through electronic readers to get in, but I had to go over to the main reception desk. Two women sat behind thick, bulletproof glass. Through the intercom system, I said to one of them, "I'm here to see Mr. Lin." "Can you fill this in, please?" She passed a ledger through a slot under the glass. As I signed my name in two boxes, she picked up a telephone. "Who shall I say is coming to see Mr. Lin?"
"My name is Stamford."
The ledger held tear-off labels. One half was going to be ripped off and put in a plastic badge container, which I would have to pin on. My badge was blue and said, "Escorted everywhere." The woman came off the phone and said,
"There'll be somebody coming down to pick you up."
A young clerk appeared minutes later. "Mr. Stamford?" I said, "All right, mate. How you going?"
He half smiled. If you'd like to come with me.
He pressed the lift button and said, We're going to the fifth floor. The whole building is a maze. I just followed him. I didn't have a clue where we were going. There was little noise coming from any of the offices apart from the hum of the air conditioning ducts, just people bent over papers or working at PCs. At the far end of one corridor, we turned left into a room. Old metal filing cabinets, a couple of 6-foot tables put together, and, as in any office anywhere, the kettle and cups, jars of coffee, packets of sugar, and a milk rotor. None of that for me, though, in freefall talk. I'd just stand by and accept the landing. Lieutenant Colonel Lynn's office was off to one side of the larger area. When the clerk knocked on the door, there was a crisp and immediate call of, Come! The boy turned the handle and ushered me past. Lynn was standing behind his desk. In his early 40s, he was of average build, height and looks, but had that aura about him that marked him out as an absolute flyer. The only thing he didn't have, I was always pleased to note, was plenty of hair. I'd known him on and off for about 10 years. For the last 2 years, his job had been liaison between the MOD and SIS. It was only as I walked further into the room that I realized he wasn't alone. Sitting to one side of the desk, obscured until now by the half-open door, was Simmons. I hadn't seen him since Gibraltar. What a switched-on boy he'd turned out to be, sorting out the inquest and basically making sure that Ewan and I didn't exist. I felt a mixture of surprise and relief to see him here. He'd had nothing to do with the Kurd job. We might be getting the kettle out after all. Simmons stood up. 6 feet tall, late 40s, rather distinguished-looking. A very polite man, I thought, as he extended his hand. He was dressed in corduroy trousers the colour of Coleman's mustard, and a shirt that looked as if he'd slept in it. Delighted to see you again, Nick. We shook hands and Lynn said, Stone, would you like a brew? Things were looking up. Thanks. Coffee, white, no sugar. We all sat down. I took a wooden chair that was on the other side of the desk and had a quick look round the office, while Lynn pressed the intercom on his desk and passed the order onto the clerk. His office was at the rear of the building and overlooked the Thames. It was a very plain, very functional, very impersonal room. Apart from a framed photograph on the desk of a group which I presumed were his wife and 2 children. There were 2 Easter eggs and wrapping paper on the windowsill. Mounted on a wall bracket in one corner was a television. The screen was scrolling through CFAX World News headlines. Under the TV was the obligatory officer's squash racket and his jacket on a coat stand. Without further formalities, Lynn leaned over and said, We've got a fastball for you. I looked at Simmons. Lynn continued. Stone, you're in the shit over the last job, and that's just tough. But you can rectify that by going on this one. I'm not saying it'll help, but at least you're still working. Take it or leave it. I said, I'll do it. He'd known what I was going to say. He was already reaching for a small stack of files containing photographs and bits of paper. As a margin note on one of the sheets, I could see a scribble in green ink. It could only have been written by the head of the firm. Simmons still hadn't said a word. Lynn handed me a photograph. Who are they? Michael Kerr and Morgan McGeer. They're on their way to Shannon as we speak, then flying to Heathrow for a flight to Washington. They booked a return flight with Virgin, and they're running on forged Southern Irish passports. I want you to take them from Shannon to Heathrow, and then on to Washington. See what they're up to and who they're meeting. I'd followed players out of the Republic before, and could anticipate a problem. I said, What happens if they don't follow the plan? If they're on forged passports, they might go through the motions just to get airside, then use their other passports to board another flight and fuck off to Amsterdam. It wouldn't be the first time. Simmons smiled. I understand your concern,
and it is noted. But they will go.
Lynn passed me a sheet of paper. These are the flight details. They booked yesterday in Belfast. There was a knock on the door. Three copies arrived, one in a mug, showing a Tasmanian devil. One with a vintage car on and a plain white one. I got the impression Lynn and Simmons were on their second round. Simmons picked up the plain one. Lynn picked up the car, and I was left with the Tasmanian devil running up a hill. "Who's taking them from Belfast to Shannon?" Simmons said, "Actually, it's Ewan. He has them at the moment. He'll hand over to you at Shannon." I smiled to myself at the mention of Ewan's name. I was now out of the system and basically just used as a K on deniable operations. The only reason I did it was to finance other things I wanted to do. What they were, I didn't know yet. I was a 37-year-old man with a lot on his mind, but not too much in it. Ewan, however, still felt very much part of the system. He still had that sense of a moral responsibility to fight the good fight, whatever that meant. And he'd be there until the day he was kicked out. Simmons handed me a folder. "Check that off," he said. "There are 13 pages. I want you to sign for it now and hand it over to the aircrew when you've finished. Good luck," he added, not meaning it at all. "Am I going now?" I said. "I don't have my passport with me. Fastball isn't the word." Lynn said, "Your passport's in there. Have you got your other docs?" I looked at him as if I'd been insulted. Passport, driver's license, credit cards are the basic requirements for giving depth to a cover story. From there, the K builds up his own cover by using the credit cards to buy things, or maybe paying direct debits for magazine subscriptions or club memberships. I had my cards with me, as always, but not my passport. The one Simmons handed me had probably been specially produced that morning, correct even down to visas and the right degree of aging. I didn't have time to finish my coffee. The clerk reappeared and took me downstairs. I signed for the documents in the outer office before I left, 13 bits of paper with the information on, and I had to sign each sheet. Then I had to sign for the folder it was in. Fucking bureaucracy. A car was waiting for me outside. I jumped in the front. When I was a kid, I'd look at people being chauffeured and think, who the fuck do they think they are? I talked shit with a driver, probably bored him rigid. He didn't really want to talk, but it made me feel better. A civilian squirrel was waiting on the pad at Battersea Heliport, rotors slowly turning. I had one last job to do before boarding. From a wall phone, I called up the family who covered for me. People who'd vouch for me if I was ever up against it. They'd never take any action on my behalf, but if I got lifted, I could say to the police, "That's where I live. Phone them. Ask them." A male voice answered the phone. "James, it's Nick. I've just been given a chance to go to the States and visit friends. I might be a week or two. If it's more, I'll call." James understood. "The Wilmots had a break-in next door 2 days ago, and we're going to see Bob in Dorset over the Easter weekend." I needed to know these things because I would if I lived there all the time. They even sent the local paper to my accommodation address each week. "Cheers, mate. When you see that son of yours at the weekend, tell him he still owes me a night out." "I will. Have a nice holiday." As we skimmed over the Irish Sea, I opened the briefing pack and thumbed through the material. I needn't have bothered. All they knew for certain was that two boys had booked tickets to Washington, and they wanted to find out why. They wanted to know who they were meeting and what was happening once they met. I knew from experience that the chances of failure were big time. Even if they kept to the script and went to Washington, how was I going to follow them around? There were two of them, and one of me. As a basic anti-surveillance drill, they were sure to split up at some point. But hey, at the end of the day, the firm had me by the bollocks. Judging from one of the documents, it seemed that we'd reached the time of the year when all good Pyra fundraisers headed for the dinner circuit in Boston, New York, Washington, even down as far as Tucson, Arizona, to catch Irish-American sympathizers who'd retired to the sun. It seemed that the seizure of 10 tons of explosives and weapons during the search of a warehouse in North London in September 1996 had produced a financial crisis. Pyra weren't exactly asking their bank for an overdraft yet, but the increase in legitimate fundraising in Northern Ireland was an indication that they were flapping. There were also other less public ways of raising cash. I was sure my new friends were part of that. Apart from that, I was still none the wiser about the job. I had no information on the players' cover stories or where they might be going, within or outside Washington. All I knew was who they were and what they looked like. I read that Michael Kerr had been a member of the South Armagh ASU. He'd taken part in 4 mortar attacks on SF bases and tens of shoots against the security forces and prods. He'd even got wounded once, but escaped to the South. A hard boy. The same could be said for Morgan McGeer. After a career as a shooter in the border area of South Armagh, the 31-year-old jobbing builder had been promoted to Pyra's security team. His job there was to find and question informers. His favoured method of interrogation was a Black & Decker power drill. Chapter 2. The helicopter was operated by a civilian front company, so the arrivals procedure at Shannon was no different than if I'd been a horse breeder coming to check the assets at his stud farm in Tipperary, or a businessman flying in from London to fill his briefcase with EU subsidies. I walked across the tarmac into the arrivals terminal, went through customs and followed the exit signs, heading for the taxi rank. At the last minute, I doubled back into departures. At the Aer Lingus ticket desk, I picked up my ticket for Heathrow, which had been booked in the name of Nick Stamford. When choosing a cover name, it's always best to keep your own Christian name. That way, you react naturally to it. It also helps if the surname begins with your real initial, because the signature flows better. I'd picked Stamford after the Battle of Stamford Bridge. I loved medieval history. I headed straight to the shop to buy myself a bag. Everybody has hand luggage. I'd stick out like the balls on a bulldog if I boarded the aircraft with nothing but a can of Coke. I never travelled with luggage that had to be checked in, because then you're in the hands of whoever it is that decides to take bags marked Tokyo and send them to Buenos Aires instead. Even if your baggage does arrive safely, if it then reaches the carousel 5 minutes after the targets, you're fucked. I bought some toothpaste, another odds and ends, all the time keeping an eye out for Ewan. I knew that he'd be glued to Kerr and McGeer unless they'd already gone airside. The departure lounge seemed full of Irish families who were going to find the Easter sun, and newly retired Americans who'd come to find their roots, wandering around with their brand new Guinness sweatshirts, umbrellas and baseball caps, and leprechauns in tins and little pots of grow-your-own shamrock. It was busy, and the bars were doing good business. I spotted Ewan at the far end of the terminal, sitting at a table in a cafe, having a large, frothy coffee and reading a paper. I'd always found Ewan a strange name for him. It made me think of a bloke with a skirt on, running up and down a glen somewhere, swinging a claymore. In fact, he was born in Bedford, and his parents came from Eastbourne. They must have watched some jock film and liked the name. To the left was a bar. Judging by where Ewan was sitting, I guessed that was where the players were. I didn't bother looking. I knew Ewan would point them out. There was no rush. As I came out of the chemist's, I looked towards the coffee shop and got eye to eye. I started walking towards him, big grin all over my face, as if I'd just spotted a long-lost pal, but didn't say anything yet. If somebody was watching him, knowing he was on his own, it wouldn't look natural for me just to come up and sit next to him and start talking. It had to look like a chance meeting, yet not such a noisy one that people noticed it. They wouldn't think, "Oh, look, there's 2 spies meeting," but it registers. It might not mean anything at the time, but it could cost you later. Ewan half got to his feet and reciprocated my smile.
Hello, dickhead. What are you doing here?
He gestured for me to join him. We sat down, and since Ewan was sponsoring the RV, he came up with the cover story.
I've just come to see you from Belfast, before you fly back to London. Old friend from school days.
It helps to know you both have the same story.
Where are they? I said, as if asking after the family.
My half left, and you got the bar. Go right at the TV, they're sitting. One's got a jean jacket on, one a black three-quarter-length suede coat. Kerr is on the right-hand side. He's now called Michael Lindsay. McGeer is Morgan Ashdown.
Have they checked in?
Yes, and luggage only.
For 2 weeks in Washington?
Suit carriers.
And they haven't gone to any other check-in?
No. It looks like they're going to Heathrow.
I walked over to the counter and bought two coffees. I could tell they were the only Irishmen at the bar because everybody else was wearing Guinness polo shirts and drinking pints of the black stuff. These two were on Budweiser by the neck and watching the football. Both had cigarettes on the go and were smoking like 10 men. If I'd been watching them in a bar in Derry, I'd have taken it as nervousness. But Aer Lingus have a no-smoking policy on their flights, and it looked as if these boys were getting their big hit before boarding. Both were looking very much the tourist. Clean-shaven, clean hair, not overdressed as businessmen, not underdressed as slobs. Basically, they were so nondescript you wouldn't give them a second glance, which indicated that they were quite switched on. And that was a problem for me. If they'd been looking a bag of bollocks, or at all nervous, I'd have known I was up against second or third division players. Easy job. But these boys were Premier League. A long way from hanging around the bogside on kneecapping duty. There were kids everywhere, chasing and shouting, mothers screaming after two-year-olds who'd found their feet and were skimming across the terminal. For us, the more noise and activity, the better. I sat down with the drinks. I wanted to get as much information as I could from Ewan before they went airside. On cue, he said, I picked McGeer up from Derry. He went to the Sinn Féin office in Cable Street and presumably got the brief. Then to Belfast. The spooks tried to use the listening device but didn't have any luck. Nothing else to report, really. They spent the night on the piss and came down here. Been here about 2 hours. They booked the flight by credit card and their cover names. Their cover's good. They've even got their Virgin cabin luggage tags on. I don't want anything to go wrong. Where are they staying?
I don't know. It's all very last minute, and East is a busy time. There are about 10 Virgin-affiliated hotels in Washington, and it's probably one of them. We haven't had time to check.
Is that all? I said.
That's your lot. I don't know how they're going to transfer from the airport, but it looks like they're off to DC, big boy.
Subject closed, as far as Ewan was concerned. It was now time to talk shit.
You still see a lot of Kev?
I took a mouthful of coffee and nodded.
Yeah, he's in Washington now. He's doing all right. The kids in Marsha are fine. I saw them about 4 months ago. He's been promoted and they've just bought a plastic mansion on this Naff estate. It's what you'd call executive housing.
Ewan grinned, looking like Father Christmas with white froth on his top lip. His own place was a stone-walled sheep farmer's house in the middle of nowhere on the Black Mountains in Wales. His nearest neighbour was 2 miles away on the other side of the valley. I said, Marsha loves it in Washington. No one trying to shoot holes in the car. Marsha, an American, was Kev's second wife. After leaving the regiment, he'd moved to the States with her and had joined the DEA. He had 3 grown-up kids from his first marriage and 2 from this one, Kelly and Aida.
Is Slack Pat still over there?
I think so. But you know what he's like. 1 minute he's going to learn how to house build, and the next minute he's going to take up tree-hugging and crocheting. Fuck knows what he's doing now. Pat had had a job for 2 years, looking after the family of an Arab diplomat in D.C. It worked out really well. He even got an apartment thrown in, but eventually the children he was minding grew too old to be looked after. They were off back to Saudi, so he binned his job and started bumming around. The fact was, he'd made so much money during those 2 years he wasn't in a hurry. We carried on chatting and joking, but all the time Ewan's eyes flickered towards the targets. The players ordered another drink, so it looked as if we were going to be sat there for a while. We carried on spinning the social shit. "How's year 10 of the house-building program?" I grinned. "I'm still having problems with the boiler." He'd decided that he was going to put in the central heating himself, but it was a total balls-up. He'd ended up spending twice as much money as if he'd got someone in. "Apart from that, it's all squared away. You should come down sometime. I can't wait to finish this fucking tour. Then I've got about 2 more years and that's me out." "What are you going to do?" "As long as it's not what you're doing, I don't care. I thought I'd become a dustman." "I don't give a fuck, really." I laughed. "You do? You'll be scratching to stay in. You're a party man. You'll stay in forever. You moan about it all the time, but actually you love it." Ewan checked the players, then looked back at me. I knew exactly what he was thinking. I said, "You're right. Don't do this job. It's shit." "What have you been up to since your little Middle Eastern adventure?" "I've been on holiday. Got some freefall in. Did a bit of work for a couple of the companies, but actually not much. And to tell you the truth, it's great. Now I'm just waiting for the outcome of the inquiry. I think I'm in the shit. Unless this job gets me out." Ewan's eyes moved again. "It looks like you're off." The two boys must have started to sort themselves out at the bar. I said, "I'll give you a ring after this is finished. When are you back in the UK? "I don't know. Maybe a few days." "I'll give you a call. We can arrange something. You got yourself a woman yet, or what?" "You've got to be pissed. I was going out with someone from the London office for a while, but she wanted to make me all nice and fluffy. She was starting to do my washing and all sorts of shit. I really didn't get into it." "You mean she didn't iron a crease in the front of your jeans?" Ewan shrugged. "She didn't do things my way." Nobody did. He was the kind of guy who folded his socks instead of putting them inside each other, and stacked his coins in their denominations. Since his divorce, he'd turned into Mr. I'm going to have the best of everything. People even started to call him Mr. Habitat. You name it. Spotlights. Three-piece suite, the lot. The inside of his sheepshagger's house was like a showroom. I could tell Ewan was watching the two players pick up their kit and walk from the bar. I took my time. No need to get right up their arse. Ewan would tell me when to move. "Do a 180, he said. "Look half right. Just approaching the newsagents." I casually got to my feet. It had been great to see him. Maybe this job would turn out to be a waste of time, but at least I'd seen my bestest mate. We shook hands and I walked away. Then I turned, looked half right, and pinged them, suit carriers over their arms. The departures lounge looked like an Irish craft fair. I was starting to feel out of place. I should have got myself a Guinness hat. What was I going to do once I got to Washington? I didn't know if somebody was going to pick them up, whether they were taking a cab or the bus, or if they'd managed to get a hotel, whether it included a transfer. If they started moving around the city, that would be fun too. I knew Washington a bit, but not in any great detail. They were still smoking like beagles in a lab. I sat in the lounge and picked up a paper from the seat. McGear started scrabbling about in his pocket for change as they talked to each other standing at the bar. He was suddenly looking purposeful. He was going to either the fruit machines or the telephone. He got out a note and leaned over to the barman, and I could see him asking for change. I was sitting more or less directly behind them and about 20 feet back, So even if they turned their heads 45 degrees either side, I still wouldn't be in their peripheral vision. McGear walked towards the fruit machines, but carried on past. It must be the telephone. I got up and wandered over to the newsagents, pretending to check the spinning rack of paperbacks outside. He picked up the phone, put a couple of pound coins in and dialed. He got the number from a piece of paper, so it wasn't one that was well known to him. I looked at my G-Shock. It was 1616. The display was still on dual time. If there were any Iraqis in the lounge needing to know the time in Baghdad, I was their man. I checked my pockets for coins. I'd about 2.5 quid. I would need more for what I was going to do. So I went in and bought a newspaper with a £20 note. The woman behind the counter looked well impressed. McGear finished his call and went back to the bar. These boys weren't going anywhere. They ordered another beer, opened their papers and lit another fag. I gave it a couple of minutes, then strolled over to the phone McGear had been using. I picked up the receiver, threw in a couple of pound coins, and looked for a number on the set. I couldn't find one. Not to worry. It would just take a bit longer. I dialed a London number, and a woman's voice said, "Good afternoon. Your PIN number, please." 2422. The digits were etched into my memory. They were the first half of the army number that I'd had since I was 16. She said, "Do you have a number?" "No, this line, please." "Wait." I heard a click, then nothing. I kept my eyes on the players and fed the phone. Within a minute, she was back. "What times are you interested in?" "I'd like to book it from 1613 up till now."
"That's fine. Do you want me to call you, or will you call back?"
"I'll call back. 10 minutes?
"Fine. Goodbye."
And that was it. No matter where you are in the world, you can dial in and the firm will run a trace. I phoned back 10 minutes later. We went through the same PIN number routine. Then she said,
"Nothing until 1610 hours. A Washington, D.C. number. 703-661-8230. Washington Flyer Taxis, USA.
I jotted down the number, hung up, and immediately dialed it.
"Good morning, Washington Flyer Taxis. Jerry speaking. How may I be of assistance today?"
"Yes, I wonder if a Mr. Ashdown or Lindsay has booked a taxi. I just want to check they're going to get to a meeting on time."
"Oh, yes, sir. We've just had the booking. Collect from Dulles. Arriving on flight number..."
I cut in. "Are you going to drop them off at the hotel? Or are they coming straight to me at Tyson's Corner?"
"Let me see, sir. They're booked for the Westin on M Street."
"All right, that's fine, thank you." Now all I had to do was try to get to the Westin before them. Everything seemed to be going to plan. Either that, or the fuckers had pinged me and were putting in a deception. The flight to London Heathrow was getting ready to board. I watched them get up, find their passes and walk. I followed. On something like this, you always travel club class. So you're at the front of the aircraft. Then you can choose either to sit down and watch people boarding, or let them through ahead of you and come in later on. At the destination, you can wait for the target to come off the aircraft and naturally file in behind. Or get out of the way beforehand so that you're ready to do the pickup once you're out of arrivals. I thought about a drink, but decided against. I might have to start performing as soon as we got to the other side. These boys seemed switched on and professional, so chances were they weren't going to be doing any work after all the bud they'd been putting away. But still, no drink for me. As I settled into my seat, I started to think about Kev and his family. I'd been there when he'd first met Marcia. I was best man at their wedding, and was even godfather to Aida, their second child. I took the job seriously, even though I didn't really know what I was supposed to do on the god front. I knew I'd never have any of my own.